Hello, my name is Adrienne Banning. I'm so glad to be your guest host again for Total EM for this episode. On this episode, we're going to talk about self-care, mitigating compassion fatigue, and burnout. Recently, those concepts became more common in everyday conversation, but it's not new. The word was first coined by psychologist Herbert Freudenberger in 1970, actually, and then more work was done by psychologist and researcher Christina Maslach, yes, of the Maslach Burnout Inventory fame. It was originally defined as a syndrome of exhaustion, depersonalization, so not just for you, but your connection with other people, and reduced professional efficacy that's encountered among employees who work with other people, anyone who works with other people. And now we know that it happens in any job at all, irrespective of the job. Any place that people face an imbalance between their job demands or what they even think their demands are and the available resources. So while it's not new, it's kind of new to talk about in medicine so openly, especially to those of us who practice medicine. And there's still a really good deal of stigma surrounding conversations of mental health, of well-being, of self-care in medicine. I think many of us trained during a time when these things were never discussed. You were kind of just told to suck it up, don't take it home, move on, let it go. During our training and during our practice, I know it's something that we talk about all the time with my PA students now. I hope that all medical training programs do, but they didn't always. In comparison, therapists often go through years of supervision, examining their practice, their emotional responses to clients. PAs, not so much. So if you aren't taught how to take care of yourself in a stressful occupation, can you teach yourself? I wondered if I knew anyone who had done this, and one person came to mind, my tattoo artist, actually. So for this episode, I've invited tattoo artist and visual artist David Allen on as a guest. For several years, David's internationally known tattoo work has transitioned to being almost exclusively comprised of mastectomy scar coverage. And even before that, he was known for his very engaged and emotionally responsive bedside manner, tattoo side manner. David's been published in JAMA and has spoken at medical conferences internationally about his work. And his daily life, he is not so unlike a clinician. He spends hours with each cancer survivor client, full days, often with their family and loved ones present for the duration. And all the time he's balancing empathy and their comfort while simultaneously thinking about his aseptic technique, his technical skills, everything else that's going on in the room. So he and I have talked before about how he learned to kind of separate different types of empathy and how to not, quote unquote, absorb so much of the weight of his clients. And they're sometimes very heavy stories. And I was hoping he could share some of that wisdom with us today. So David, welcome to Total EM. Thank you for being here.
Oh my gosh. Thank you for having me. That was a wonderful introduction.
We're so glad to have you. So David, you have a very unique perspective on what self-care means to an individual facing very heavy matters in their work life, as well as what it means to the care of the service that you provide. Can you kind of talk more about your journey and what you've learned about self-care and kind of heavy situations?
Sure, absolutely. I didn't realize the extent of what I was getting myself into. I understood what had happened literally as far as the removing of cancer and then the mastectomy reconstruction, some without reconstruction. I understood literally what was going on. I had done a lot of research. But what I didn't recognize was the amount of trauma emotionally these people had faced and hadn't processed. Mm. It wasn't even a concept I had thought about. I just kind of did the work. And the more time I spent, when you spend 3 to 6 hours with somebody, you're really in it. You're in the thick of their stories and they're facing things. They can't move. They're under slight duress. And you're kind of allaying their nerves and their fears. They tend to really face and look at elements of trauma during their process that maybe they hadn't.
Right.
Well, all of that was intense. There's this ebb and flow of emotions, and I was connecting to that. I tend to mirror people easily. So I would go home disconnected. My son wanted to hang or just talk about our day or play video games, and I was really disconnected.
Mm-hmm.
So It was it was me making a choice. Do I disassociate? Do I just step away from this, or do I face it? This is something we all kind of go through. So it took a lot of work and a lot of research. What I realized was in reading is they've shown that people that have a background in psychotherapy tend to not suffer from compassion fatigue as much. So with that data, it was time for me to look into therapy. It was time for me to look into gaining these skills, help for the helper.
Right.
Therapists learn these skills. Some of them seem really basic, but it's about mindfulness and being aware of your emotions.
Mm-hmm.
The next stage was really understanding what trauma was. If you can't look at your own trauma, how can I understand someone else's trauma? That took a lot. That's a lot of work. That's a lot of raw work. But you realize that it happens when this emotional pain can't find it can't find a relational home in which it can be held. Yeah, so we adapt, right? Our tendency is to survive and maximize available resources. So these are experiences that can't be integrated. So our body, we just kind of store them implicitly.
Right.
Where time is not really involved in this process. It's just so much. We don't want to fragment. So we separate. We kind of quiet that which we can't bear the weight of. We find stability, protection to avoid distress. And we continue on this path that removes the threat, but in a limited, diminished state.
So like a survival.
It's survival. And I didn't want to...
Yeah.
I was doing that myself, you know, be it situations in my childhood or even just through life. Trauma is relative.
Mm-hmm.
So you have these default coping mechanisms that kick in from your childhood. And unless you don't take the time to stop and look where they actually come from, you're just going to exist the same way the rest of your life.
Right. They worked for you at some point. You developed them for some reason. Sometimes you just don't always need them anymore.
Yeah. Well, and sometimes they're not healthy. They're maladaptive too.
Right.
For instance, drinking. I started, drinking was never an issue to me. Then suddenly I saw myself drinking a little more heavy when I had a rough day or I had to hear about, you know, someone's metastatic cancer for four hours, which I want to hear and I care, but it's a lot to take in.
So maybe there was some self-medication?
Yeah, absolutely. I think we all do that in our own ways.
Yeah, absolutely. Clinicians of all type. I haven't checked the stats lately, but I'm pretty sure it's maybe commonly held, maybe it's anecdotal, that clinicians have higher rates of substance abuse, of alcohol use, higher rates of burnout than the general population, surely. And so we're all kind of facing it in different ways.
Absolutely. And it's something, it can be difficult to talk about, especially within the medical community. I've seen that when I talk about it, sometimes people get a little squirmy, and I understand that. It's also frowned upon to have any mental health issues.
Sure.
That is difficult for me to talk about therapy or to suggest therapy. I see a lot of that squirming and I get it, but it's important.
Yeah. I really appreciate that you've shared that. It makes a lot of sense. You had to kind of identify it for yourself, kind of coming in, not knowing that this was the work you were going to get into. There are some risk factors that providers, PAs, physicians, nurses can think about. We do have recent evidence that was just published in JAPA, actually, of May of this month of 2020, about how we kind of present our burnout differently. I'll put that reference at the end for everyone, but PAs tend to have higher rates of burnout than other workers, but feel pretty satisfied with their work-life balance. Physicians have more burnout than other US workers and are unsatisfied with their work-life balance. Nurses, on the other hand, not feeling so much burnout, but are unsatisfied with their work-life balance. So it's not really a band-aid for even a profession, let alone for an individual. But there are some things that raise risks of burnout. The American Medical Association has shared these. So if you identify with working too many hours, taking night or weekend call, doing work at home, having a work-home conflict, that increases your odds of burnout 250%. Mm. Practicing, in certain specialties, you can guess them, emergency, general internal med, neuro, they increase your odds. Private practice, though, increases your odds no matter what specialty or your work hours. If you receive incentive pay, if you're a mid-career, in this case, physician, because it's from the AMA, if your career doesn't fit with what you find meaningful, and the ever popular using computerized order entry or enduring other clerical burdens, they say. So you didn't really have those boxes to tick, but maybe some of the listeners were thinking like, oh yeah, I didn't know that that was contributing, or I knew 100% that these are contributing and I have all of them.
Sure. Yeah.
For you, was there some type of wake-up call? Was there a moment when you recognized you wanted to do something differently to help take care of yourself differently?
I think it was cumulative. I started to hear a lot of stories of how doctors or nurses would make small mistakes, as simple as maybe using the wrong words that affected somebody, or just the way that these small, more forms of trauma would affect patients. I say clients, but patients. Mm-hmm. And it showed me that I wasn't as aware of processing trauma as I should be. So if I am going to be someone that sits with someone for 3 or 4 hours, I'm not a therapist, but if I can look at myself and I can step back a little from my own emotions and bear witness to myself in the middle of processing, it has shown me how these people are doing the same thing. So just hearing these stories, it taught me to be honest with myself. I've lived a life personally where I just want everything to be okay. And even at the expense of being honest in relationships and life, in small things, I just want things to be okay. So I kind of just skim over things and makes life easy for me. I'm saying that, and that's being vulnerable, but I'm saying that because that's what this has required, is me being a little more vulnerable to people that I may not know. That's what they wanted. They wanted this space. I saw that as soon as I was vulnerable, they were able to be vulnerable. Mm-hmm. So they could talk about their trauma. They could give me their history. And in that history, I understand it, a more accurate context, and I can see how to be and how to listen. Now, I feel the emotions more and it hurts more. You know, we mirror and things light up in the same places. But creating the safe space is what enabled me to listen and actually create a final product that was more apt to what they wanted and fit their personalities and help them, like in their hierarchy of needs. I just kind of learned how to listen instead of put up a front and try to get the information that I specifically wanted. This is me saying, what am I missing? Not me saying, yeah, I understand you.
When you say vulnerable, I don't think that you mean you're like sharing deep, dark secrets with your clients. It's kind of this vulnerability, it sounds like, to look inward, right? To maybe look at things that you were trying to avoid.
Sure.
I kind of heard you say that you were trying to like avoid conflict before, and maybe that's even like within yourself.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of this stuff stems from early on, right? Childhood development and right. Parental things. And you want things to be okay always. Let's say I did, and I do. So I see that in myself. And now I've learned to, you know, I've hurt people in that. I've hurt people in relationships. I've hurt friends. I've hurt clients in the sense of not being directly honest about how I feel. How do you feel about that?
Right.
And I would just say, it looks great. Or maybe it really didn't. I can actually give you my honest opinion and let you have the opportunity to know what the truth is. That's important to me. That's being vulnerable, the vulnerability of being honest and also connecting. And I do think it is letting your guard down. I don't think it's dark secrets or anything like that, but I think it is being open. And if you can't be open to yourself, though, if you can't look at yourself, it's, you know, you can act like you're being open and you can try and fake it till you make it. That works too. But really learning to be aware and have mindfulness has changed everything for me.
Right. And in that, there's this aspect of kind of letting go of control of the other person's response. You don't want there to be conflict. So you say something that maybe isn't the truth or your own truth because you're hoping the person will respond another way. When you never had control, that was a hard lesson for me, that I have to be vulnerable to say what I'm really thinking, and you can respond however you want to respond.
Sure.
If I'm being honest with myself, though, it goes a lot smoother in the end.
Yeah.
Mostly.
Yeah, right. Well, also, I think part of that too, though, is understanding your emotions and seeing that those too can be passing. You know, it's rare. Like as humans, we have the ability to reflect and digest our own way to beyond trauma. We can witness in the middle of it. That's beautiful. So to be able to be aware takes time. And in doing so, you're kind of regulating your responses. And so what's honest is you looking at yourself, and, you know, you can apply some rational thought to those emotions as well. I think that has given me the strength to feel safe, because I am learning myself. Before, I was just kind of off the cuff.
Know thyself.
Sure.
Gosh. One of my favorite books, I don't know, a book that I sometimes have turned to when I didn't know what to do is called There's No Good Card for This, What to Say and Do When Life is Scary, Awful, and Unfair to People You Love. It's by Kelsey Crowe, who's a PhD, and Emily McDowell. They suggest two ways to kind of get ready to take care of others by taking care of yourself, which is what we're talking about. And there are two things are to let go
right.
of guilt, huge. Mm-hmm. Catholics, raise your hands, and resentment. So guilt, you're not perfect. That's okay. We mess up. We mess up in medicine. So society doesn't want us to, our colleagues don't want us to, we don't want to, but we're human and we're held to these ridiculous
right.
standards that we'll never meet unless we can accept that the standards are ridiculous and we're human. So we have to forgive ourselves for past mistakes and stop being so hard on ourselves for the times that we weren't. But they also point out that's not an excuse to do nothing just because you won't be great at it. Like, okay, you weren't perfect. Forgive yourself, but try to get better. But then on the flip side, other people are human too. They're not perfect. They might be carrying their own guilt around, but also we carry resentment when people weren't perfect to us. Maybe they didn't give you like what you hoped for, what you thought you needed in the moment. But in this book, they kind of point out they gave you something. They gave you a learning moment. Can you let go of the grudge and take a learning point away? And that takes a lot of introspection too. All right, your guilt, forgive yourself, but then forgive other resentments when other people weren't perfect. Is that a peer, a colleague, family? Is it one of your administrators? They're two huge things. Do you have anything to add to that? Does that resound with you at all?
It does. I think it all centers around emotional regulation.
Okay.
So absolutely, absolutely. Becoming focused and calm, learning yourself and your signs. It's work. And it doesn't seem, even in saying it, when I sit and want to, if I want to help someone going through something, it's kind of a simple answer, but to do it takes time. And that's difficult. So we get aroused, like hyper arousal happens, especially if we're talking about trauma. Before emotions get too high, we can be aware of our bodies, how we hold ourselves. And they can be mitigated with the right tools. Can I go into some of what I do?
I would love that, please.
Is that okay?
Yes, please do.
Because we can talk about this all day. We can talk about trauma and revisiting trauma. But these are some tools that I've used. It's just based on mindfulness. It's based on relationships in life. And it's based on being honest to yourself. So I think with mindfulness, it was hard for me, but I take time and I'm learning how to meditate.
Okay.
It's really important. Meditation, being aware of your thoughts, letting them pass, learning how to control your mind and see where your mind goes. Along with this comes breathing. Breathing is so important. Once you can regulate your breathing, you have a control system. You can calm yourself down in ways and bring yourself into a different state. I know it doesn't sound like much, but even when I'm tattooing someone for 4 hours, if I can concentrate on their breathing and help them, it changes everything. Even when they start to breathe fast, I will breathe slower. They mirror me. They don't know it. And they start to slow down their breathing as well. And it helps. It's all mindfulness, learning yourself, journaling, reading. I think another thing is listening to yourself, getting to know yourself. You start to trust and know your limits when they appear. You learn that sometimes if there's limits, you know, you can dip your toe in the water a little bit, but sometimes you got to back out.
Mm-hmm.
This is kind of being somatically aware of your breathing, of your tenseness in your shoulders and your neck.
Mm-hmm.
There are signs that you have to start to be aware of. And so that takes me to relieving stress and set a time to. This for me is silly stuff. It can be video games. It can be watching Netflix and vegging out, mentally relieving stress, letting myself not feel guilty for doing so.
Right.
Connecting to your patients, connecting to my clients as people, connecting to my family, connecting to friends, noticing them. We need that connection. And these are all things that seem really basic, again, but it's really important to have family, to have friends, to see your patients for who they are, being aware and present in your situation when you're talking to someone, not thinking of what to say next, but listening and being present and engaged. You become part of a larger whole, and you start to kind of be aware of it, and it changes your outlook even a little bit. Okay, resources. I like to find resources. It can be within your community, within like fellow physicians online. I've seen that some are joining Facebook groups for doctors. I follow way too many doctors on Twitter.
Do you?
I do, especially now. Especially, I'm sure you probably do. WhatsApp groups, group texts. I have a small little story that really spoke loudly to me. I was in Paris at a breast congress.
As one does.
And we had a dinner. I was out of place there. It was a bunch of surgeons and doctors, and we all had dinner on a boat on the river. And I was so excited. This is not normal for me. And as soon as the food came out, the first course, a handful of doctors pulled out their phones and started showing each other photos of trauma, of cancer, of surgeries, of open wounds.
Right.
Yeah, right.
And again, so as first, you do in our world.
Right. Well, so I didn't know that world then, right?
Yeah.
It was a little off-putting for me at first. We're about to eat food. But I felt like I could be transparent and open, especially there was someone next to me that I trusted. And I was just direct. Hey, why are you doing that? Mm-hmm. And he thought, and he pretty much told me that, you know, I think we do this to cope. I think we do this to show each other that we've been through it. I don't know. Right. It's just normal for us. And maybe if it's normal for someone else, it takes a little of the load off. And what I see now is this is something we can't experience at its entirety. So we process in little bits and pieces. And I think it's okay. Little bits. Yeah.
Little connections. And
that shook me up. So that was their community. That was them just, hey, I've been through it too. Hey, I've been through it as well.
Yeah. They were connecting before they sat down together.
Right. Shocked me, but now.
I don't think we have a lot of space to do that, where we can kind of come together, you know, kind of maybe semi-professionally. Conferences is definitely one of those things, but the community that comes out of that is what you're saying, that your community is a resource, and you saw that happening in one element.
It really shocked me. And I use that example often because what I saw is something macabre. It was not that at all. It was actually quite beautiful.
Oh. Do you do anything else? Any other?
I do. I don't like to talk about it, but I'll just be completely direct with you. I think therapy is incredible. I like to tell people to go to it, but I really think learning vocabulary for your emotions, or having someone that likes you and doesn't love you, having someone safe to talk to about what you've been through, and they can guide you dipping your toes in that water of traumatic memories. You know, we're processing these memories, even if they're not traumatic memories in general. They help you. They see, they're aware when maybe you've gone too far, and they'll pull you back. Having someone as a guide through your own process is beautiful. And the catch is, it takes time. They have to develop your story. They have to learn who you are and understand your context so they can be accurate. That's important. So therapy.
I love therapy. I'm with you there. Absolutely. To have that objective view, to know when you're like thought distorting, to work through stuff. I don't know if we were having this conversation, I don't even 5 years ago, if we would both be like, hey, stranger, do you go to therapy? I love therapy. Yeah. What does your therapist say? But now there are accounts that, you know, my therapist says. I like that that's becoming destigmatized. And I'm really glad that you said that too.
I agree. I think the last thing is your body, being aware of your body. I think it's important to say that before I stop talking about things I do. Well, I remember hearing a podcast that the lady gave an example of when you walking down the stairs, and if you go to fall, when you go to fall, your arm just instinctively goes out and holds right. the banister, right?
Yeah.
A lot of what we do, a lot of when trauma is stored, it's stored implicitly, right, to your amygdala. So our actions, a lot of them pull directly from these implicit memories. Our body stores so much trauma. So this isn't something that we can just discuss emotionally. So I think it's important to connect to your body. It can be as simple as exercising, letting yourself be present. Yoga is incredible. It helps you become mm-hmm. more self-aware. But this stimulates us in ways that we need, like both to affect our implicit memory and our explicit memory. I can't overemphasize enough what being aware of your body, and even me, it took going to physical therapy some. Mm. I hold things in certain places that I didn't even realize. Or, you know, part of even my personality, I'm a little shy at first, but I even hold my body that way. I've learned how simple stuff, putting my shoulders back, how it has affected me in ways, and even how I feel. Mm. I even went to Second City. I took some acting classes just to understand empathy on a different level. And it was more body-based than emotional attunement. And that kind of shocked me. I loved that.
Hmm. We didn't say before, but you're based in Chicago. So you have
I'm based in Chicago,
access
yes.
to Second City. That's really cool. How did you have that idea? Did you just decide that? Was it something brought up to you? How did that come about?
Well, a perk of my job is I get to really meet my clients. So uh-huh. I've tattooed a few actors or Broadway actors that discussed it, because I kind of go into this stuff a little bit. It's kind of nice to talk about it with some people yeah. and hear their take or their view. And when you hear an actor talking about how they dive into their empathy or into their mirroring skills, they create these sometimes, you know, their own version of what a context will be, and then they live in that context. Well, a lot of it can be, you know, if you walk across the room with your chin to your chest, you have a completely different temperament than if your chin is up. So small little movements, small little just changes that can greatly affect you and me. And so, I don't know, a lot of clients direct me towards really interesting and fun activities to keep me working on myself and entertained.
Nice to be able to do two at once. It's a lot of work. You've put a lot of time and effort into this. Kind of navigated this process. Has it evolved for you? Are you doing now kind of what you started out doing? Is it different now than when you first started kind of paying attention to these things?
I think so. I think it's like a muscle, right? You can process more information over time. So I started to see how people are affected within their space. The actual environment itself has been important. Also emotionally, you know, like literally and figuratively, I think having an emotional safe space. So you learn how to create just a whole environment where someone feels okay to share their story. And also I've learned now to be mindful of people they bring with them sometimes. Maybe one or two people, there's tension between a few of them. So I can balance that shift. I've sent people to go get coffee while I talk with someone because they're kind of in the way. I think all that's important. You start to be aware of all the little things, the way, the nonverbal gestures, you know, picking up on people on a micro level. You never assume that you have the answer. You never assume that you know, because you want to come from a place of neutrality. And I think my process has been more me clearing my mind and being a better person and learning how to be neutral than anything else. And everything else kind of trickles out of there. I'm not sure if that's the best answer. That makes sense to me.
It's an evolving practice, it sounds like.
It is.
Yeah. And you're kind of learning with your artist's eye, you're learning to do a general assessment. Those things that we kind of all take in a snapshot and say, there's sure. something happening in this room, and how do you kind of break it down? We don't need to go back to it. I just want to say that I heard you say amygdala before. I loved it. One of my favorite phrases is nothing gets past the amygdala. It's the first processing center. It's where we store emotions, our fight or flight. Yes. Nothing gets past the amygdala. I'm gonna have that tattooed. Actually, do you know anyone?
I don't, oh. sadly. Oh.
So you talked about you were your process, where you've kind of come to, maybe where you are now. You've talked about how that might help you interact with the people that come along with your clients. Has it changed how you interact with your clients? Have you noticed a different interaction as you've kind of put these things into place? Any feedback or the work that you do, has that changed at all because of these changes that you've made to yourself?
It has. I like the distinction. It has. I feel like I can listen on a different level now because I'm able to remove myself. All this effort spent knowing myself has translated into being able to remove myself from someone else's equation. So listening, it's so important. When my responses are in tune with somebody, they feel heard, they feel the value that they have intrinsically, and then more information comes out, right? So listening, being aware, watching their body change as they're processing pain, taking little breaks that I wouldn't have taken before, for me to be aware and to stretch and to listen to my body, also gives them space to be alone with themselves. That's important. This isn't just about me. It's this dance where we're both creating something together. Also, protecting them in the middle of the tattoo is really important. Sometimes, I don't know, maybe a partner gets bored or a partner gets, I've had people that get in little arguments during it. So I have to protect the space and I feel more connected and able to mitigate those emotions because I'm not in my own. I try not to mirror those as much. I can kind of pick and choose now a little more. So it's constantly changing. There's always flux, but the idea is I'm self-regulating. So I'm kind of the governor. Mm-hmm. And I don't want them to know that. It's their project, but I'm there and I'm present. I'm saying the same thing over and over, but the idea is, yes, it's changed my interactions with my clients much more. It used to be more about me and my ego. It used to be more about what I thought was good for them. Mm-hmm. You know, I used to actually do the designs of the tattoos the day before, and they would come in. And because I spent time on the design, I would argue with them when they want it changed.
Right.
That's not okay. So now I've learned to actually do the process with them where I see what their needs are. And then based on their needs, we create something, not based on what I deem best. That's huge.
I'm sure listeners can relate to that. So you said this kind of started, you're coming home and you're feeling kind of disengaged, that depersonalization, coming home and spending time with your son. Is that different? Do you come home differently?
I do. I'm more aware of my time at home now. So there's this thing that I do where it's almost a routine now where I leave my shoes in my studio and I put on new shoes when I leave, when I go home.
Like Mr. Rogers. Actions.
Sure. Yeah. Just like, I wear a cardigan too. That's really weird. it's important for me to be aware and cognizant of what's going on here. And I want to leave it here. There are times when someone leaves and I break down and I'll cry. I'll weep for, 30 seconds or maybe 5 minutes. That's a long time, but I go through it and I look at it. If I can look at it fully, if I can't look at it fully, I'll look at it more later, but I have to make a point to. So when I go home though, I've actually processed a little, I've gone through some of it and then I'm home and I'm aware and sometimes it's difficult. So I'll take a break. Hey buddy, I'll be back. I'm going to take a shower for half an hour. And then I come back and then now I cook more. Him and I are learning how to cook together. That helps.
Oh, that's fantastic.
It's great. I don't have much time. So we do that HelloFresh thing and they send us ingredients and we spend time with each other doing that. Or he's playing games on the PC. And I used to do that when I was in college. So he thinks I'm cool finally for the first time. These are moments though that before it was me sitting on the couch, TV was on. I wasn't even paying attention to the TV. I was just kind of trying to avoid, or that's when I would have a drink. Hmm. Or that's when I would, you know, it was all these different. So it's not that anymore. It's going through it bit by bit, piece by piece, and being present with my boy, being present with myself. It's good stuff.
It's all good stuff. Hopefully all this good stuff helped someone today listening towards some introspection or gave you some ideas about how to reach out to a colleague that you think might be struggling. They're big ideas and problems. They don't change overnight. And I kind of also want to make the point, not kind of, I do also want to make the point that this is not an individual's problem that an individual has to fix. The burnout that we're facing in the medical profession is systematic. It influences us as an individual, but it's not all up to you and like how you just need to do more yoga and you need to do more of this.
Right.
But it starts kind of where you can make these changes individually while you're working to change the system. I definitely want to give credit to Lawrence Levy. He's the author of From Pixar and Beyond to Pixar and Beyond, who, you know, was a bigwig at Pixar and then kind of transitioned into more Eastern philosophy and talking about physician burnout. And he definitely talks about it can't all be on the individual. It has to be systematic too, but while we're trying to change the world, we have to kind of start and take care of ourselves a little bit.
I think that's important that you said that. Thank you for saying that. Yes, I'm saying all this stuff and I'm giving you tips on what I've done. You're absolutely right. This is way bigger than just individual. But if you're there and you're going through it and there's nowhere to turn, there are small things that kind of help.
Yeah.
You know, can give you some hope.
Yeah, we've talked about a lot of resources. We're definitely going to share those at the end. They're big experiences.
These are experiences we can't really digest without taking little bites.
Little bites. That sounds doable. David, thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Until next time, continue to provide total care everywhere.